prompt you negotiating. Grain in plenty. Now there is something we could all celebrate. Within the month we will dispatch a trade delegation to Buckkeep. Shall we raise a toast to opening our borders? More than one toast was raised that evening. Perseverance cheeks were flushed with wine when I saw Lant and Spark exchange a look. Spark put a hand to Purr's shoulder and steered him out of the festivities with dignity, if not with the steadiest of gait. A short time later, I pleaded fatigue, and Amber retreated with me, leaving Lant to represent the six duchies for the rest of that evening. As we made our slow ascent, she said quietly, "Within King Rain's own family, there are people severely changed by the Rain Wilds in difficult ways. His sister..." I knew what she was asking. "Even for his sister, I do not dare."
"No, I was merely telling you of her. She is in Treehog now, visiting her family. Even if you were willing to take the risk, you could not. But if there are six duchies healers who could help the Rain Wilders, the six duchies could gain powerful allies."
I sat up until dawn creating my letter to King Dutiful. I composed my words, fully expecting that several people would read them before they reached him, if they ever did. I was circumspect, saying only that we had reached Kelsingrar and secured passage to Jamalia. I asked him to arrange passage home for Lant, Purr, and Spark, and told him that he might expect an ambassador from the dragon traders with a trade proposal. I added that it was imperative that Skillmistress Nettle be present for all negotiations. I wanted to say more. I dared not. I rolled my missive tightly, dipped it in wax, and pushed it into the small cylinder that would attach to a pigeon's leg. I wished I could skill a warning to Nettle. These dragon keepers claimed to be elderlings and heirs to this city and all its wonders. How would they respond if they knew of Aslavjol and the battered treasures there? Would they attempt to claim them, or offer to pool their knowledge of that magic with ours? Shade would have seen a rivalry, Ketrican, a natural alliance. Dutiful and Nettle? I did not know what they would see. I wondered if my use of the skill here had been the pebble that would trigger an avalanche of war, or become the first tiny block in building a shared legacy of magic. It was agonizing to say so little, and to know that it might be days before I could even attempt to reach out with the skill. The exact day of the Tarman's arrival was uncertain, for the river ran higher and swifter with the melting of distant snows. We each dealt with that waiting in our own way. The need to keep my skill walls tight and be ever vigilant against the current of skill and memories in the city wearied me. I took my meals within our chambers and graciously declined as many visitors as I could. The skill-induced weariness that assailed me meant that I seldom ventured out into the city. I remembered Kelsingrar as the deserted city I had first encountered on my quest to find Verity. It had been my first experience of traveling through a skill pillar, and had happened by accident. The city had been dangerous to me then. Ironically, despite my having studied skill magic, the skill-infused walls and streets of the city were more dangerous to me now. But the skill flow of the city was not the only danger. Thrice General Rapskal came rapping at the door of my chambers, and always he seemed to arrive when the others were away. The first time, I feigned an even greater weakness than I felt. He insisted that he needed to talk to me, but I wavered where I stood, apologized, and then slowly but relentlessly closed the door. After that, I did not open when someone knocked. Lady Amber retained a healthy wariness toward General Rapskal. She spent her days within the walls of the greeting hall. She visited Malta and passed on to me their gossip of old friends, and recent news of both Bingtown and Treehog. Lant, Spark, and Perseverance were as entranced with Kelsingrar as a babe with a new bauble, and the keepers seemed both willing and pleased to share the wonders of their city. I warned them to be cautious and let them explore. Purr, with Motley the Crow on his shoulder, had quickly become a favorite with the servants and unwittingly gave me a great deal of information on the inner workings of Kelsingrar when he shared gossip of an evening. In the evening in our chambers, Amber and Spark did repairs on their bare-tossed wardrobe, while Amber told the tales of old Buckkeep, including the adventures of the notorious Lady Time. Purr asked her once about her childhood. She spoke of a farming family, of an older sister thrilled to have a sibling at last. She told of gentle rolling hills that turned gold in summer, of tending docile brown cows. Then she stopped speaking, and I knew that the next part of her tale must be about Clarys. She told no more stories that night, and I dreaded that I must soon dredge those memories for every pertinent fact as to the layout of Clarys. She had locked those recollections away, and yet I must find a way to open them if our plans for vengeance were to succeed. The fool was the one who had first demanded that I go to Clarys and kill them all. He had desired his own vengeance even before they had kidnapped Bee, even before Dwalia had taken her into the skill pillars and lost her there. He had been intent on their slaughter. With great care, I had tidied away my life at Buckkeep and attempted to depart alone, to seek that far city and take my own vengeance. I'd had no concern for my own survival afterward. But not only the fool, but Spark, Purr, and Lant had followed me. Three of them I could send back to Buck, but for the fool to survive, I must wring from him every detail he recalled of Clarys and the servants of the Whites. But how? How to pry that essential information from someone so adept at concealment and diversion? On a day that was more lingering winter than spring, most of us had opted to stay inside the warmth of our chambers, but Purr had been restless. He had paced and stretched and sighed until I had surrendered and given him permission to explore on his own. Late in the afternoon, he burst into the chambers, red-cheeked and tousle-haired, to exclaim, "Martley has made a new friend!" We all turned toward him in surprise. "Martley met another crow? Remind me to blacken her white feathers, or that friendship will be short-lived," I replied.
"No! Not another crow!"
He fairly shouted the words, then caught his breath and assumed a storytelling tone.
"I was behaving very carefully, as you bid me, speaking only if spoken to and saying little then. But few people were out in the cold today. Martley had found me and was riding on my shoulder. We were walking towards a plaza with a statue of a horse when a big gust of wind hit me, very cold, and Martley lifted off my shoulder. Then she cried out, as if she were a minstrel. 'Oh, beauteous one, red as scarlet berries on a frost-kissed vine!' As if she were reciting a poem. The gust of wind was a red dragon landing right in front of me. Her claws clattered on the cobblestones and her tail lashed. She barely stopped short of trampling me. I scrambled backward and fell, skinned my palms catching myself," he added, and held up his reddened hands for our inspection.
"Was the dragon threatening you?"
Lant demanded breathlessly.
"No, not at all. She was just landing there. Still, I was scared and decided to leave. I called Motley back to me, but she flew over to land right in front of the dragon. This time she said, 'Oh, beauteous one, Scarlet Queen, feeder of crows!' And the dragon stretched her head down, and I thought she would eat Martley. But instead, Martley did a little dance."
Purr opened his arms, bobbed his head and wove his body about like a courting bird.
"Then what?"
Spark demanded breathlessly.
"The dragon's eyes were spinning like spring-fest tops. She put her head flat to the ground, and Martley hopped over and began grooming her, twiddling her beak along the scales of the dragon's face, going around her eyes and nostrils. The dragon made this very strange sound, like a kettle boiling."
"And then?"
Spark sounded envious at missing the spectacle.
I stood and waited for her. When my feet were numb with cold, I called to Motley to come with me, but she didn't even turn her head. The dragon's eyes were half closed, like a big sleepy cat. So I left her and came back.
His brow furrowed as he asked me,
"Do you think she'll be safe?"
"I think she will. Motley is a very clever bird." I wondered if dragons and crows shared an ancient connection. Crows are notorious bone-pickers of true predators. An alliance between crows and dragons seemed only natural. "A very clever bird," I repeated, and I knew she was a mystery that would only be solved when she chose to reveal herself to me.
"She is," Purr exclaimed proudly. "That she is."
On a day of gentle sunshine, I woke from an afternoon nap to find myself alone. I felt befogged and listless, and hoped a short walk around the city would enliven me. Wearing my fine Prince of the Six Duchies cloak, I ventured out. The distant trees on the hills behind Kelsengrar had a blush of moving sap in their white branches. Some willows, perhaps, were dotted with the green of swelling leaves, as if someone had threaded beads onto their slender branches. The mountains had shed their snow. How many years had it been since Night Eyes and I had subsisted on their forested flanks, hunting like wolves and sleeping sound? A lifetime ago. Perhaps two. The voices of elderling memories muttered to me from the skill-threaded stones of the building. At first, it was distant, like the buzzing of mosquitoes, but it soon became urgent, like bees swarming. The press rasped at my walls, shaving away my defenses. I turned back when I began to hear clear snatches of conversation and to see the shadowy forms of elderlings. The skill current swelled around me like an ocean wave that would slide my feet out from under me and carry me far from shore. I'd been an idiot to venture out alone. I had turned back toward the greeting hall when I became aware that Rapskull was following me. My efforts to block the ancient elderling whispering had deadened my awareness of those around me. I slowed my pace and walked unsteadily. Let him think me weaker than I was. In truth, I judged myself too enervated to withstand the attack of a determined child, let alone this elderling soldier. He quickly fell in beside me.
"Prince Fitzchivalry, I am glad to see you are somewhat recovered from your magic."
"You are kind to say so, General Rapskull, but even this brief stroll has wearied me. I shall seek my bed as soon as I return."
"Ah, well, I am disappointed. I'd hoped to have words with you. Important words."
The last he added in a lower voice, as if someone might overhear us. Did he wish to deliver a private threat? But when I glanced at him, he met my gaze with a pleading look that was almost apologetic.
"I've misjudged you. Hebe has told me I must change my mind."
His gravity increased.
"She had a dream, or perhaps she remembered something. She has conveyed to me that your quest is a just one, one she supports."
He lowered his voice to a whisper.
"She wishes me to aid you in any way I can to destroy the servants and their city. In any way."
He leaned close and put his hand on my arm, conspiratorial. His eyes glittered as human eyes should not. My wariness became alarm when he confided,
"Your crow and Hebe have become very close friends."
"Hebe?" I queried, trying to smile in return.
"My crow?" "My dragon. You know of Hebe, I trust. She is my scarlet darling."
For a moment, his smile became a grin, making him a lad.
"She likes your crow. Motley, I think she is called. Motley praises her and tells her of her beauty. Before the crow came, I was the only one who admired her as she deserved. Hebe has become quite fond of Motley, but that is not what I wished to discuss. Your mission, to kill the servants of the Whites. Hebe approves of it.
I tried an interpretation of his words. Your dragon had a dream, or remembered that she would like us to kill the servants of the Whites? He grinned wider, white human teeth in a dragon-changed face.
Yes, exactly.
He was so pleased that I understood. I stopped walking. I put my hand on the stone facade of a building, thinking to lean there and rest. A mistake. The street suddenly thronged with elderlings, blue and silver and green, tall angular folk with fancifully scaled faces and artfully draped garments. There was to be a contest of musicians today in the Plaza of the Queen, and the Queen herself would give the award.
Hello? Wake up, Prince. I'm taking you back to the greeting hall. The voices are not so loud there.
I was walking, and General Rapscal had my arm firmly hooked into his. The contest of musicians faded like a dream. Rapscal was guiding me. Perhaps he had been talking to me. I'm not well, I heard myself say.
You are fine, he said comfortingly. You simply weren't prepared. If you choose which voice you will hear and ready yourself to share the life of that elderling, you can learn a great deal. I certainly did. Before I welcomed the elderling memories of an ancient warrior into my mind, I was a bumbling, stupid boy, earnest and tolerated by my fellow keepers, but never respected. Never respected.
He closed his mouth suddenly on his quavering voice. I revised my estimate of his age downward. He cleared his throat.
My dragon Hebe has suffered similarly. She has never spoken much to the other dragons or their keepers. When she first came to me, she was small and clumsy. The other dragons disdained her. She could not even recall her proper name. I had to give her one. Yet of all of them, she was the first to fly and the first to make her own kills.
His chest swelled with pride, as if she were his little child. He saw I was paying attention and gave an abrupt nod. We had stopped walking.
My chamber, I said quietly. I need to rest.
And my words were true.
Of course, he said. I am happy to take you there.
He patted my hand on his arm, and I sensed far more of him in that brief touch than I liked. We began to walk, more swiftly than I wished, but I gritted my teeth and kept pace. I hoped Lant would be in the rooms when we reached them. Then I wondered when I had begun to count on him to protect me. Suddenly, I missed Riddle.
So,
he concluded, and I wondered what I had missed while my thoughts were wandering.
That is why anything that Hebe remembers or dreams is so important.
We had reached the greeting hall. It seemed dim inside after the brightness of the day. Two elderlings turned and stared as he escorted me to the stairs.
Up we go, he said cheerily.
He was stronger than he looked. Thank you for your assistance, I said when we reached my chamber. I'd hoped he'd leave me at the door, but he followed me in.
Here, sit at the table. I'll request food.
I had little choice but to sit. The struggle to keep the elderling voices out of my mind had sapped my physical energy. Under the guise of settling myself, I made sure of the little blade Riddle had given me, hidden along the waist of my trousers. If I needed to, I could draw it and possibly manage to cut soft butter with it. I tried to summon anger that might wake some strength in my wearied body, but I found only fear that made my knees even more uncertain of their function. Rapskull's outward friendliness did not calm my wariness of him. His temperament, I judged, was uneven. And yet he was astute. He alone had seemed to realize we were not being completely honest with the good people of Kelsengra. But was I dealing with a ruthless military leader who would do whatever was necessary to defend Kelsengra, or a melancholy youth concerned with his dragon's dreams? He joined me at the table, having pressed the flower ornament by the door. "How does that work?" I asked him, hoping to take his measure a bit more. "Pressing that flower?"
"I've no idea. It just does. Down in the kitchens, a similar emblem glows and hums. One for each room."
He dismissed my question with a shrug.
"There's so much we don't know. It was only 6 months ago that we discovered those chambers were meant to be a kitchen. There is a basin there that fills with hot or cold water, but no ovens or hearth. So it's a peculiar kitchen. Not that my mother ever had an oven, or even a kitchen that I remember."
For a moment, he fell morosely silent. Away from the skill tumult of the streets, I wanted to hear more of his dragon's dream. But I also had to warn the others before they walked into the chamber. I did not trust this rapscal. Not at all. Was his dragon dream a far-fetched ploy to get into our rooms? I waited 3 breaths, and then said, "Your dragon had a dream about Clarys?" He jolted back to awareness of me.
"Clarys, yes. That was a name she recalled. So it was a true dream then, one based on her ancestral dragon memories."
He sounded delighted.
"I'm confused. Ancestral dragon memories?"
He smiled and propped his chin on his fist.
"It's not a secret any longer. When a serpent transforms into a dragon, it wakes with the memories of its dragon ancestors. It knows where to hunt, where to nest. It recalls names and events from its ancestral line. Or so it should. Our dragons were sea serpents too long and spent too short a time in their cocoons. They emerged with fragmented memories. My Hebe recalls almost nothing of her ancestry. But sometimes, when she sleeps, memories come to her. I hope this means that as she grows, she may recall more of her ancestors' lives."
His eyes went wide, and for a moment they gleamed. "Tears? From this ruthless man?" He spoke softly, in a wounded voice.
"I love her as she is. I always have, and I always will. But to recall her ancestry would mean so much to her."
His gaze met mine, and I saw a stricken parent.
"Am I heartless that I long for this too? That I think she would be better? No, she is too wondrous as she is for anything to make her better. Why do I want this so? Am I faithless?"
The worst that can happen to an assassin is to find common ground with his target. But I knew that question too well. How often had I lain awake beside Molly, wondering if I were a monster because I wished my daughter were as able as other children? For an instant, it was as if our hearts pumped the same blood. Then Shade's training whispered to me.
"There it is, the chink in his armor."
I had my own mission to think of, and the fool. I needed information, and perhaps this boy general had it. I spoke gently and leaned toward him as if entranced with his tale. I warmed my voice with false kindness. "How wondrous, then, that she dreamed of the servants and Clarys. I take it neither you nor she has visited that far place. Feed him some bits of my information to see what he might betray. Above all, maintain a calm demeanor. Pretend this was a social visit rather than a mutual assessment of strengths." My ploy worked, his face lit with joy.
"Never! Those are real places, then? Real names? It must be a true memory she recalled, not a yearning dream.
His chest rose and fell with excitement. His eyes that had been so guarded were suddenly wide and open. I felt something go out from him. It was neither the skill nor the wit. A peculiar blending of the two. Was that what bonded Keeper and Dragon? I knew then that he had kept his walls up while we spoke, but now he opened to Hebe and shared with her that her dreams were true recollections. Somewhere in Kelsingrar, a dragon trumpeted in joy. The distant caw of a crow echoed it. Or had I imagined that? I nudged him with words. Clarys is real, as are the servants. I have little other information to share with you, I fear. Our journey carries us toward the unknown.
For vengeance?
He queried me quietly.
For vengeance, I confirmed.
His brow creased, and for a moment he looked almost human.
Then perhaps we should join you, for what Hebe recalled of that place was dark and distressing. She hates and fears it in equal measures.
What does she recall? I asked gently. He scowled.
Little detail. There was treachery and betrayal. A trust violated. Dragons died. Or were perhaps slaughtered.
He stared at the wall as if seeing something at a great distance, and then snapped his eyes back to me.
It isn't clear to her, and so it is all the more disturbing.
Would the other dragons recall what she does not?
He shook his head. It is, as I have told you. All the dragons of Kelsingrar emerged from their cocoons with incomplete memories.
Tintaglia and Icefire. I held my features still. Neither of those dragons had been members of the Kelsingrar brood. Tintaglia had hatched years before the Kelsingrar dragons and had believed herself the sole surviving dragon in the world. My personal experiences with her had been exceedingly unpleasant. She had tormented Nettle, invading her dreams and threatening her, and me, all in her pursuit to have us unearth Icefire for her. That truly ancient dragon had chosen to immerse himself in a glacier when he believed himself the last dragon in the world. The fool and I had broken him free of that ice and restored him to the world. His recall of what befell the other dragons should be intact, and from what I knew of him, my chances of learning from him were very small. General Rapskull was still musing on his dragon.
My Hebe is different from the other dragons. Always smaller, stunted, some would say, and I do fear that she may never grow as large as the others. She seldom speaks, and when she does, it's almost exclusively to me. She shows no interest in making a mating flight.
He paused, and then said,
She is younger than the others, both as a serpent and now as a dragon. We believe she was of the last surviving dragon generation before the final cataclysm took them all. Once, when dragons were many, dragon eggs hatched yearly into serpents. The serpents within then quickly made their way into the sea. There they would remain, swimming and eating, following the migrations of the fish until they were large enough to return to the Rain Wild River and travel up it to the cocooning beach near Treehog. So it was once. Many of the dragons have ancestral memories of helping serpents to form and enter their cocoons, and the following summer, the dragons would emerge from those cocoons, strong and fully formed, ready to take flight for their first hunts.
He shook his head sadly.
It was not so for our dragons. They got lost. They remained as serpents far too long. For some great disaster changed the coast and the river so greatly that they could no longer find their way to their cocooning beaches. Hebe and I believe that several generations of serpents were caught in that disaster, trapped in the sea for far longer than they should have been.
I nodded. Speculations of my own had begun to boil within my mind, yet I knew it was essential to hear all he had to say. No need to tell him that I knew more of those two elder dragons than he did.
Hebe suspects that not all dragonkind died when the elderling cities fell. Certainly, Icefire did not.
His voice went very dark.
I have given this some thought as well. It might seem that all the elderlings who lived here in Kelsingra died. But they did not. I have walked in the memory of one elderling who lived through whatever events split and shattered this city. Through his eyes, I watched the ground tremble and elderlings flee. But where? I think to other places marked on the map in the tower.
He paused and looked at me. It taxed all my discipline to keep my face bemused as he said,
I do not know how the magic was done, but they fled through the standing stones. The same stones where I first encountered you.
They fled through stones? I asked, as if uncertain of what I had heard.
Through the stones,
he said. He watched me carefully. I kept my breathing slow and steady while regarding him with great interest. The quiet stretched long before he spoke.
I grew up an ignorant boy, Prince Fitzchivalry. But not a stupid one. This city has a story to tell. While the others have feared to be lost in the memories stored in the stones, I have explored them. I have learned much, but some of what I have learned has only led to more questions. Does it not seem odd to you that in one disaster, every elderling and every dragon in the world seems to have perished?
He was now speaking as much to himself as he was to me. I was content to let him talk.
Some elderling settlements were destroyed. We know that. Treehog has long mined the remains of one buried elderling city. Perhaps others fell as well. But humanity did not die out, nor parrots, nor monkeys. So how is it that every elderling vanished from the world, and every dragon? Their population would surely have been greatly reduced. But to die out entirely? That is too strange. I saw many flee when the city died. So what became of them? What became of the dragons who were not here when the city fell?
He scratched his scaled chin. His nails were iridescent and made a metal-on-metal sound against his face. He lifted his eyes to mine.
Hebe recalls treachery. And darkness. An earthquake is a disaster, but not a betrayal. I doubt that elderlings would be traitors to their dragons. So whose treachery does she recall?
I ventured a question. What does Icefire say to your questions? He gave a snort of disdain.
Icefire? Nothing. He is a useless bully. To dragons and elderlings alike, he never speaks to us. When Tintaglia had no other choice, she took him as her mate. But he proved himself unworthy of her. We seldom see him here in Kelsingra. But I have heard a minstrel song of Icefire's freeing from a glacier. An evil woman, pale of skin, attempted to kill him. A white prophet, some call her. And this is what I wonder. If someone had killed the dragons and elderlings, would they not wish to put an end to Icefire as well?
The tale of Icefire and the Pale Woman had reached as far as Kelsingra. I had been known as Tom Bajalok then, and few minstrels knew of my role in the downfall of the Pale Woman. But Rapskal was right. Icefire would certainly have a reason to hate the Pale Woman, and perhaps the servants as well. Was there any way to wake that hatred and persuade him to aid me in my vengeance? I rather doubted it. If he would not seek vengeance for his own wrongs, he would care little for wrongs done to a mere human. I led his thoughts away from Icefire. I do not understand all you have told me. The dragons of Kelsingrar are different ages, but I thought all the Kelsingrar dragons had hatched from their cases at the same time. He smiled indulgently.
There is so much the outside world does not understand about our dragons. From a mating to the laying of an egg to the serpent entering its case, a generation or more of humanity may pass. And if sea serpents encounter years of poor feeding or are swept away by storms or lost, then even more years may pass before they return to spin their cases. The serpents that finally were guided by Tintaglia to the cocooning grounds were all survivors of a terrible calamity, but some had been in the sea for scores of years longer than others. They had been serpents since dragons ended, and no one knows how long dragons have been gone from this world. Hebe and I believe that she was the youngest of the serpents to reach the banks of the Rain Wild River. Her ancestral memories, poor as they are, retain the most recent history of the dragons before their near extinction.
It was time to ask my most important question. Does Hebe remember anything of Clarys, or the servants that might aid me in my quest to destroy them? He shook his head sadly.
She hates them, but she also fears them. And I can think of nothing else that she fears. She wavers from demanding that I should rally all our dragons to your cause, to warning me that we must never go near that place. If her dreams bring her a clear recollection, she may resolve to take her own vengeance.
He shrugged.
Or if those memories are sufficiently terrifying, she may decide to avoid Clarys forever.
He stood abruptly, prompting me to slide my own chair back and tighten all my muscles. He smiled ruefully at my wariness. I am not a short man, but even if I had been standing, he would have towered over me. Yet he spoke courteously.
Even if my dragon cannot muster, at present, the will to avenge her kind on these servants, I would wish to kill them all myself. For her.
He met my gaze squarely.
I will not apologize for how I behaved when you first came to my city. My caution was warranted, and I am still dubious about much of your tale. No one saw you descend from the hills into Kelsingrar. Your party arrived with more baggage than I believe you could comfortably carry. None of you had the weathered look common to folk who have made a long journey through the wilderness. I could not help but regard you with great caution. I had believed that only the elderlings of old could use the standing stones as portals.
He stopped speaking. I met his gaze and said nothing. A spark of anger glittered in his metallic eyes.
Very well. Keep your secrets. I sought you out not for myself, but for Hebe. It is at her bidding that I aid you. Therefore, despite my own reservations, at her urging, I offer you this. I am forced to trust that you will reveal this gift to no one, human, elderling, or dragon, until you are well away from Kelsingrar. What use you might have for it, I cannot imagine. By touching dragon silver, Lady Amber has dipped her fingers into her own death, and printed death onto you with her touch. I do not envy either of you, but I do wish you success in achieving your mission before death takes you.
As he spoke, he had reached into his waistcoat. My fingers found the haft of Riddle's knife, but what he drew forth was not a conventional weapon. I thought the fat tube was made of metal, until I saw the slow shifting of silver within it.
Few of the containers the silver workers used survived. The glass is very heavy, and the glass stopper is threaded to ensure a tight fit. Nevertheless, I counsel you to handle it carefully.
You're showing me a glass tube of skill. I would assume nothing. He set it on the table, and it rolled until he stopped it with a touch. The tube was as fat around as an oar handle, and would fit solidly in a man's hand. He reached into his waistcoat again and set a second tube beside the first. The glass chinked lightly as they touched, and the silver substance inside it whirled and coiled like melted fat on top of stirred soup.
Showing you? No, I'm giving it to you. After what Hebe has shared with me, I assume that your Lady Amber requested it to use it against the servants. So here it is, your weapon, or your source of magic, or however you need to use it. It is from Hebe, given freely by a dragon, as only a dragon could grant you dragon silver.
There was a tap at the door. He picked up the silver and shoved it at me.
Conceal it,
he told me harshly. Startled, I fumbled my hold on the tubes and then gripped them. They were warm and much heavier than I'd expected them to be. With no other hiding place close by, I shoved them inside my shirt and folded my hands at the table's edge to conceal the bulge as he went to the door.
Ah, your food,
he announced, and admitted a serving man who gave him a wide-eyed look before carrying a tray to the table and beginning to set out food before me. His brow was scaled, as were the tops of his cheeks. His lips were flat and taut, fish-like, and when he shifted his mouth, I glimpsed a flat, grey tongue. His eyes, too, moved strangely when he turned his gaze to me. I looked away from his unvoiced plea. I wanted to apologize that I could not help him, but dared not open that discussion. I shamed myself by quietly thanking him. He nodded dumbly and backed out the door, his eyes skimming over Rapskull. News of my visitor would swiftly reach the kitchens and spread as only gossip can.
Will you join me?
I asked the general. He shook his head.
No. I expect that within minutes you will have one or two more of the household dashing through that door to be sure I have not harmed you. A pity. I should like to learn how you travel by those pillars, and why Hebe says you smell like you have a dragon companion, but not one she knows. I suspect there are things I know that would benefit you.
He released a sigh.
So much is lost when there is no trust. Farewell, Prince Fitzchivalry Farseer. I hope the trade and magic alliance you have proposed for our peoples prospers. I hope it does not end in war.
Those chilling words were his farewell. The moment he closed the door behind him, I rose and took the glass tubes of skill to my pack. I hefted the vessels thoughtfully and watched the slow swirl when I tipped them. I studied each stopper. They appeared to be tight and felt slightly tacky, as if resin had been added to the seal. I tucked each into a heavy sock, doubling the ends over, and then put them into a thick wool hat before snugging it into the bottom of my pack. The glass of the tubes appeared heavy and strong, but I would take no chances. Indeed, I agreed with Rapskull. I would tell no one that I had this, least of all the fool. I had no idea why Amber had asked for Dragon Silver. Until she saw fit to divulge what she had planned, I had no intention of putting it at her disposal. It had alarmed me that she had silvered her fingertips, and I could still not sort out how I felt about the fingerprints that once more graced my wrist. I sighed. I knew my decision was sensible, and wondered why I felt guilty about it. Worse than guilty. Deceptive and sly. The others breezed in later that afternoon, full of tales of the city. In an ancient arboretum, the trees had long perished, but there remained statues that slowly changed their poses, and a fountain that chortled with the voices of happy children.
Both Lant and Spark had seen the faint shapes of elderlings moving among the ghosts of green trees and climbing vines. Amber nodded to that account, but Perseverance looked forlorn.
"Why do I hear and see nothing?"
he demanded.
"Even Amber hears their whispers. When the dragons fly over, the others say they hear them calling to one another, mostly insults and warnings about hunting territory. But all I hear is the bugling, not that different from the calls of elk in rut."
The indignation in his voice bordered on anger.
"I wish you could hear and see what we do,"
Spark offered quietly.
"Why can't I?"
This he demanded of me. "I can't say with certainty, but I suspect it's something you were born with, or without. Some folk have an affinity for a magic, the skill, or the wit. If they have the affinity, they can develop it, rather like herd dogs are born with the concept of bunching sheep and hound pups that follow a scent even before they are taught the fine points of it."
"But dogs can be taught to herd or hunt, even if they are not those breeds. Can't you teach me to see and hear what the others do?"
"I'm afraid not." Per glanced sideways at Spark, and I sensed perhaps a rivalry, or simply a wish to share. Lant spoke quietly. "I don't see or hear as much as the others do."
"But I hear and see nothing at all!"
The words burst from the boy. "That might be a gift rather than a lack. Perhaps you should think of it as an armor against magic. Your imperviousness was why you could resist the impulse to join the others in the carriage drive on the night Withywoods was raided. It was why you could help Bea to stay hidden as long as she did, and to help her try to escape. Your deafness to the skill and to the magic of Kelsingra may be as much of a shield as a weakness." If I had thought to comfort him, it failed.
"A lot of good that did her,"
he said miserably.
"They still took Bea from me, and they still destroyed her."
His words damped all our spirits. A morose silence fell. Whatever pleasure they had taken in the magic of the city was engulfed in the miasma of recalling why we had come here. "General Rapscal came to see me today," I said, dropping the words like stones into a still pool.
"What did he want?"
Amber asked.
"Did he threaten you?"
"Not at all. He said that he came to wish us success in our quest for vengeance, and that Hebe, his dragon, had a dream about the servants. And Clarys." I summarized my visit from Rapscal. A profound silence followed my words. Per was the first to speak.
"What does all that mean?"
"Rapscal suspects that some great disaster befell the dragons. He believes that Hebe hates the servants of Clarys because they somehow murdered the remaining dragons, or as many as they could kill." Lady Amber's face had slackened into the fool's features. In the fool's voice he whispered,
"That would explain so much. If the servants foresaw a disaster to the dragons and the elderlings, then they could plan to make it worse. If their goal was to eliminate all dragons from the world, and they succeeded, then they might foresee that we would try to restore them. And so they would create the Pale Woman, and hold me captive at the school, and send her out in my place, to be sure that the dragons had no chance of being restored."
His gaze went distant as he recalled all we had done.
"The pieces fit, Fitz."
Then a strange smile lit his face.
"But they failed, and we brought dragons back into the world."
A shiver ran up my back and stood my hair on end. How far ahead had the servants planned their strategy? The fool had once hinted that they had used him to draw me away from Withywoods so that they might steal Bea. Did their dreams and omens warn them that we were coming? What other obstacles or distractions might they devise for us? I smothered those fears. We still don't know why they wanted to destroy the dragons. He shot me the fool's mocking glance.
"I said it explained much, Not all. The servants play a very long game with the world and the lives of all those in it, and they play it only for their own good. I would speak with this Hebe and see what else she can recall.
I don't think that's wise. I think all of us should avoid General Rapscal as much as we can. He does not seem stable. Today he was courteous, even kind. Nonetheless, I do not trust him. He told me plainly that he does not believe our story of how we came here, nor how you silvered your fingers. He strongly suspects that we came by the pillars. He glimpsed you near the dragon's well on the night you dipped your fingers. Fool, for all our sakes, stay clear of him. For a long time he was silent. Then his features assumed the poise of Lady Amber.
I suppose that is the wiser course, and you say that Hebe speaks only to him? Would any of the other dragons recall anything of the servants, do you think?
I don't think so, but how could we possibly know? I pondered a bit. Icefire knows. He survived whatever befell the dragons, and of his own will entombed himself in ice. He should recall those times. He would know if the servants had anything to do with the extinction of the dragons. I suppose it's possible he shared that tale with Tintaglia.
But he is not here. Many of the dragons went to the warm lands for the winter. Some went 2 or even 3 years ago. I gather that Icefire left and has not returned.
A cold dread uncoiled in my belly. I tried to keep it from showing on my face. Fool, Lady Amber, what is the climate like on the White Island, and near the nearby lands? She fixed her blind eyes on me.
Warm, mild. I never knew winter until I travelled north to the 6 duchies.
She smiled, her face falling into the fool's lines.
It's beautiful, Fitz. Not just the White Island, not just Clarys. I mean the other islands and the mainland. It's a gentle land, a much kinder place than you have ever known. Oh, Buck is beautiful in its savage way. It's stark, a stern land, and it makes folk as stony as its bones. But my land? It has gentle, rolling hills, wide river valleys, and herds of cattle and flocks of sheep. Not the rangy creatures you call cattle in Buck and the Duchies. Big brown cows with sweeping horns and black muzzles, their backs head high to a man. It's a rich and easy land, Fitz. Farther inland, there are golden-shored lakes that teem with fish, and there are steaming springs in the wooded hills.
He sighed, and seemed lost for a time, perhaps recalling the days of his childhood. Abruptly, Amber cocked her head at me.
Do you think that is where dragons go when the winter freezes the land here? Or went at some time?
I imagined gentle rolling pasture lands, fat cattle stampeding in terror, and swooping dragons. That would explain why the servants would wish to eliminate them. Dragons have not proven favorable for the 6 duchies. Perhaps the servants found them more than an inconvenience. Did the servants know how to kill dragons? Were there dragons that would never return to Kelsingra?
Let me ponder this and recall what little I know of the dream prophecies that mention dragons.
Amber scowled suddenly, and it was the fool who said,
And why has it never occurred to me to wonder why there are so few dream prophecies that mention dragons? Are there no dream prophecies of the rise and fall of the dragons? Or were they suppressed?
Suppressed, I thought to myself, as the fool suppressed his memories of Clarys. I needed to unlock both those mysteries. A slow plan to do so began to unfold in my mind. Chapter 6. Revelations. I first dreamed of the destroyer when I was still on Aslivyol Island. Beloved's catalyst had returned for a second time. I believe his presence triggered both my dreaming and the vision of the destroyer. In that dream, the destroyer was a fist gripping a flame. The hand opened and the flames flared tall, but instead of giving off light, they brought darkness, and everything I had ever known was destroyed. It had been so long since I had dreamed a dream that I told myself I had imagined it was significant. Had not I just achieved all my goals? Why would a dream so dark come to me amid my triumph? Nonetheless, I was moved to say to the White Prophet and his catalyst that the time had come for them to part. One of them, at least, accepted the truth of my words, but I saw that they both lacked the will to do what they must. I undertook to separate them. The Writings of Prilcop the Black. My recovery was slower than from any physical injury I had experienced in decades. Clearly, my old skill healing did not repair whatever the skill itself had drained from me. Focusing my thoughts was a challenge, and I tired easily. And my afternoon with General Rapskal had taxed me gravely. Even in this so-called quiet building, the skill current sang and surged around me. But that did not mean there was not work to do. Information to gather, regardless of barriers. No matter how weary I was. That night, I sent Perseverance down to the kitchens to beg brandy and a glass for me. He had returned with a large bottle of Sand's Edge. Carrot is from the Rainwilds and very hampered by thick scales on his face and hands, he had informed me as he set out the bottle and a glass. He said you deserved only the best and asked me to remember him to you. I'd sighed. My steady refusals to attempt any more healings had not stopped the requests and courtship of those afflicted with dragon changes. With an understanding shrug, Per left me alone in my room and went off to bed. I was sitting on the bed, bottle beside me and glass in hand, when Amber came in after a late dinner with Malta. I greeted her after I drained the last drops of brandy from my glass. "Did you have a pleasant evening?" I asked her in a slow voice.
"Pleasant enough. Little to show for it. Ice fire has been gone for months now. Malta isn't sure when he left. All know that Hebe doesn't speak to anyone except Rapskal, and Malta had heard that Rapskal had called on you and was concerned."
"I hope you told her I was fine, though truly I shouldn't have ventured out into Kelsengrah. The skill current out there is like being tumbled down a river full of boulders. I don't know if it's because I've been trained to be aware of it and use it, or because there is so much silver here. Perhaps I made myself vulnerable to it somehow when I did those healings and let it course through me without restraint." I lifted the bottle. "Will you have some?"
"Somewhat," she sniffed the air. "Is that Sand's Edge brandy?"
"It is. I've only one glass, but there are cups still on the table."
"I will, then. It would be shameful to make you drink alone."
I kicked my boots off, let them thud to the floor. I let the bottle's neck clink on the lip of my glass as I dribbled a bit more into it. Then I lay back on the bed, staring up at the dimmed ceiling. Stars gleamed against a deep blue sky. They were not the only illumination in the room. The walls had become a forestscape. White flowers gleamed on the swooping branches of trees. I spoke to the stars. "So much skill coursing through this city, and I dare not use it at all." I did not watch as Amber discarded her skirts and wiped paint from her face. When I felt someone sit down on the edge of the bed, it was the fool in plain leggings and a simple shirt. He had brought a teacup from the table.
"And you still dare not venture to help any of the dragon-touched folk? Not even with the smallest complaint? Scales growing down over the eyes, for example?"
I sighed. I tapped the neck of the bottle lightly on the edge of his teacup to warn him, and then filled it well. I know the man you speak of. He has come twice to talk to me, once to beg, once with coin. Fool,